Hi everybody, can you hear me? Hello? My name's Barry S and I work for Erica. I'm going to not pace around, I feel like a motivational speaker. I'm going to stand over here. Hi, thanks for coming, it's really great to see you. The first thing that I would say, it's a really boring thing, but we're really trying to, like, any structure that you impose is obviously a problematic structure, but even so, we've tried not to have a front to the discussions, and there's no kind of hierarchy of who can sit at the table and be part of those discussions or feel comfortable up here. So if anybody wants to join us, that's really cool. Also, if you want to just sit where you are, you know, I'm not going to take that personally. And the idea, I suppose, with all of these things is that we just try and build up over the course of the weekend our like kind of shared, let's think, like a shared exploration or inquiry into the interrelated nature of our everyday lives, our politics, and our art forms. I suppose that's what's going on. I wanted to say a few things as people are getting settled. I'm sort of killing time. But so one thing I'd like to do would be to introduce my friend Mark. He's going to tell you about a little thing that's happening in relation to this episode and that you might be invited to take part in. So go on, Mark.
Hi, yeah, so my name's Mark. I'm one of the editors for a website called Glasgow Review of Books. And we wrote a couple of pieces about the episodes 4 and 5 last year, but we wanted to do something a bit different this year. And that's hopefully going to take the form of a meeting sometime next week to reflect on this weekend and to continue the explorations and the inquiries that Barry was just talking about. So obviously, it's going to be hard to say what that will be like because the weekend hasn't really fully happened yet. But we're looking to sort of talk and think out from whatever happens here this weekend. So hopefully we can kind of reflect on what's happened, but also talk about how the ideas and the struggles we're discussing speak to ours in Glasgow and speak. And there was a conversation on Thursday about the relationships between here and elsewhere. So I'd really like to kind of encourage that. Logistically, I guess the best thing to do is the email address is on the website. It's glasgowreviewbooks.com. So you can email me there just to say that you'd be interested, or come and find me during the weekend, and I'll gather all the email addresses for a mailing list, and I'll send an email out next week with the time and the location. Thanks, Ruben.
Thanks, Mark. Okay, so when Bryony and Amelia and Ash and I were writing the introduction to this episode, I'm just going to read it out because I'm hoping that Sadia and Fred are going to help us understand what we wrote. This episode is about dissonance, divergence and disruption. It's about flight and fugitivity. It explores the gap between the presumed social norms of race, sex, gender and sexuality and the qualities of lived, real experience those norms fail to allow for. It is about the ideological weapons of control democracy utilises to create spaces so tight it seems impossible to manoeuvre within them. And it asks whether it is possible for communities, even while so constrained, to practice being somewhere else, practically, socially and aesthetically making a way out of what is at hand and in rehearsing in anticipation of what is to come. You don't have to answer that directly, actually, but that was my way of introducing you both. So I'll hand over to Fred and Sadia. Thank you very much.
Well, we figured that the first thing we should probably do is try to give some attention to the terms that the program has us sort of listed under. So I'm just very eager myself to hear Sadia talk a little bit more about waywardness.
Yeah, I mean, I think of waywardness as very akin to fugitivity, it being a related mode. I think for me, in terms of thinking through these forms of making life and thinking through politics and practice through that term, what was important about it was that it was a way of kind of labeling Black women and young Black women's practice as outside the norm. They were wayward, right? That ultimately that their form of life was wayward, that their forms of loving were criminal. But it seemed that in that waywardness was another vision of the possible. So I wanted to take it up as both, you know, kind of a way to address the forms of life they were refusing and then the forms of life they were attempting to make. So it also seemed in line with thinking about errantry as well, divergence, wandering, all these ways of kind of reducing certain imposed narratives of development, whether, you know, becoming a certain kind of subject or having a certain social trajectory.
Well, just for me, the term fugitivity, first of all, is a term that it has a very specific genealogy from in the way that, in terms of my reception of it. So it emerges from in the work of Nathaniel Mackey, who's a poet and novelist and literary critic, and who's just been a tremendous influence on me and a bunch of other people, my generation, writers and scholars. And for him, the notion of fugitivity is something that he derives from Amiri Baraka's work. And specifically, he mentions fugitivity in relation to an essay Baraka wrote in which he's talking about this saxophonist named John Chikai, who Baraka is talking about his playing as a kind of playing that slides away from the proposed. Right. So this notion of a kind of sliding away or going off the track, moving against the grain or even in an appositional way towards that which has already been given or towards a line which has previously been laid down. And thinking about that specifically as in terms of how it plays itself out at the level of sound, a kind of one way to think about it would be, and he also talks about it, for instance, in relation to Rashawn Roland Kirk, who there's this great song called The Business Ain't Nothing But the Blues, in which Rashawn Roland Kirk is playing the flute but also humming into the flute while he's playing. And so it creates this kind of splitting of the sound, as if elements of the sound that is emitted from his breath and his mouth are going in different directions. So it's a kind of fugitivity from that moves away from what's given, but also a fugitivity within that movement that moves away from the given. So the fugitivity is a kind of cascading effect. It never ends. That you can be running from the man, but that running from the man also always implies an almost immediate divergence from oneself too. It's a condition that can't really be contained, can't be held back. Anyway, so it was that line, and of course, this is all happening against the backdrop of slavery. So that the notion of the fugitive as the runaway, someone who's trying to escape. And I think the other part about it for me was always that it opened up the possibility of valorizing fugitivity or escape over against freedom as some notion of arrival, you know, of having achieved a thing. So.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that, you know, if we wanted to think about waywardness, I mean, we could think of it as another elaboration of fugitivity in a distinct moment. I mean, it too is a kind of, I would say, like a re-elaboration of one's own with the given or the imposed. So you're operating in this, you know, context of really brutal constraint. So what do you make in that context? Like, how do you dwell in the context of the uninhabitable? And, you know, there's a great book called by Savolia Glimp, Out of the House of Bondage, right? And it's looking at Black women's domestic work, and she says that basically Black women, you know, could, they weren't able to escape the house of bondage. Like what they did under slavery was they worked in the house, and in like the northern city, 90% of black women were, you know, confined to domestic work. So the house of bondage awaited them there. So waywardness becomes a way of kind of elaborating that fugitivity in these radical different contexts. So people complain that they, you know, that they will quit a job on a whim, right? That there are all these ways in which they're involved in making. I mean, Marx might describe this as subsistence, right? So how do we think about the art of making life in the context of extreme deprivation, dispossession, you know, and assault? And even he says that, you know, that to make a life is also to create a form of life, right? So I was really thinking about what is then this art of subsistence, and there are all these practices that are antagonistic, that are refusal, that are derelicts, that are precisely about staging a kind of contestation of the terms of order, but they're, you know, culturalized as pathology, or they're just simply criminalized, and that, but that the kind of the larger social and political text of those acts is obscured or lost. So seizing upon waywardness was a way to read all of this kind of, I guess, the radical thought of working class black women that have been articulated in their deeds mm-hmm. and their forms of everyday life, right? They were, you know, involved in a kind of both anti-work politics and in a kind of, you know, and in a practice of the general strike. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, it's thinking about those practices that were developed in the context of enslavement, but their shift and transformation in these new circumstances of the slum.
Yeah. It's like there's all this kind of ungathered matter and energy of refusal or revolution that, and it's not like you're trying to gather it because it's more free and radical or more free radical if it's like if it's not codified and if it's not contained and all of that. But still, you want to be able to tell a story about it so that people can access it, so that people can find it. So, like, you can find this thing that's moving through you, right? Like, and what I'm trying to say is, like my grandmother cleaned up this old, evil white woman's house named Susie Campbell, right? And she didn't leave that job on a whim. I think in a weird way, she almost kept going on a whim. Like, I think she had to decide every day for 20 years to go back into the house of bondage because it meant being able to do these things she wanted to do, namely, you know, raise my mother, send her to school. But there's this way in which she then had to develop a whole new set of modalities of refusal within the context of that choice to go back and to remain. And one of her main ways was just the persistence of which she called her Susie. Like she, and my grandmother was a great musician and played the piano at church, but she had the capacity to say Susie in that way that, like there's this great, like you know that song about the Michael Jackson, Remember the Time? Remember
that, you know? Yeah.
And if you listen to the first couple of choruses of it, he says remember like 19 different ways. It's like this tour de force of just phrasing and just the intensity with which he produces these constant subtle variations on refusal, on remember. And I feel like that's the way my grandmother did with Susie. She would say it with a different level of critical contempt. With every pronunciation. It was like she had to continually produce this rich critique and refusal of that woman as the counterforce to having to keep going to back, you know? And it, well, the book that it resonated with me so much was Tara Hunter's book,
To Join My Freedom.
Yeah. And it's so much about, as you say, this very specific waywardness that is sort of taken up by the figure who is the impossible domestic, right? The domestic, but the one who can never really be domesticated. The matoikos, right? The one who is inside the house, but at the same time always already outside the house, right? Never really a part of the house, you know?
And that becomes that impossible domestic figure becomes also, you know, a way of describing wrong types of kinship and affiliation and intimacy, right?
Mm-hmm. It's like... these brutal, forced modalities of intimacy, like, that, you know, that then require all these shifts and moves and maneuvers, you know? I mean, to me, even to the point of then creating a situation in which the most intense and most thoroughgoing example of fugitivity, to me, is Harriet Jacobs, whose fugitivity is expressed in sequestration, in like locking herself basically in a crawl space for 7 years, right? That this modality of escape that requires staying put. And I was thinking about it last night, actually.
But you know, in the way we've only just recently been able to think about it in that way, and I think so much for me is, you know, in what, Silencing the Past, Michelle Roth Trio talks about the way the Haitian Revolution was unthinkable within the terms of a certain Western political imagination and historiography. It could not think the event of the Haitian Revolution. And for me, so many of the parameters of our discourses, our disciplinary practice, literally cannot think Black women's activity and thought. It is the domain where like nothing at all is produced, mm-hmm. right? So what happens if we attend to this domain where seemingly nothing happens? Then we get, you know, like, oh, a fugitivity that seems to be its opposite, mm-hmm. a more intense mode of mm-hmm. confinement.
Well, it's like that the interview you did with Frank Wilderson, the position of the unthought. But what's so problematic is that the position of the unthought doesn't even really show up as a position. Right, it's a kind of apposition or a non-position, and it's dance. So I seen last night. I was looking at at Pony and at Miss Prissy, and I was like, this music is a music which seems to me to be designed to foster people achieving positions. This constant, fleeting. Temporary posing, or this constant fleeting, homeless, temporary striking of a position. I'm saying striking a position to echo like strike a pose, but it's different to strike a position, because to strike a position is also to leave the position, like strike the tent, right? Mm-hmm. It's just, you enter into these positions in order to leave them, right? And there's an emphatic kind of punctuated quality to it. And so, for me, the dance was just another embodiment or enfleshment of this thinking, you know, that not just the thinking that we're trying to do about this thing, but what we're trying to do is to think about and study an already existing, already given modality of thinking and study. That waywardness is a mode of thought, you know.
No, I mean, it's so also, and this is, two lines of thought that go in different directions, because, you know, when we think about, you know, what it is people do and how it's named, you know, my kind of polemical version of this book, you know, project is the revolution before Gatsby, because, I mean, in a way, what's kind of celebrated about the Murphys, et cetera, is like the beautiful art of doing nothing. Right? But in another context, that's just like idleness and criminality and shirking. But I was thinking like, oh, part of what the shirking is about is just the sense of there's all these Black strikers mm-hmm. that are always visible. And I was thinking, you know, that's what Du Bois was seeing before he wrote Black Reconstruction. He was seeing all of these shirkers and strikers in thinking about the agency of flight and refusal and able to imagine it as a politics, because in the John Brown book, he's not talking about the general strike, mm-hmm. right? And so what is it, and it's not simply like a belated arrival at Marxism, but it's about being able to kind of apprehend certain forms of social practice mm-hmm. and illuminate them as thought and yeah. radical action.
Yeah. Well, Marxism was trying to be a belated arrival at that. Still is, I think. You know.
So should we? Do you want to?
Well, the only thing else I was really thinking about waywardness in relation to Killer of Sheep, and because it was such an amazing thing. Well, when you described your talk yesterday, or your reading, or what, I don't know what it was your reading, your recital yesterday, it was to talk about it, you introduced it as a series of moving pictures, which is, to me, totally important, because, first of all, it just links up that particular historical moment that you're talking about is already a part of. Well, on the one hand, you could call it the age of cinema. But on the other hand, by way of Kara Keeling, you could talk about it as the cinematic, which she brilliantly requires us to understand the cinematic as being totally bound up with the color line, like they're inseparable, right? The cinematic, I mean, I shouldn't talk about, oh, there she, well, you're here to correct me, so it's fine if I fuck this up, right? So, like, but, but just the cinematic is this term from this French philosopher Gilles Deleuze, who I think is meaning to suggest not just a particular mode of image making, but a kind of massive conceptual and sensual apparatus that actually prepares us to see in a certain kind of way. And so what Kara is doing in this one amazing book called The Witch's Flight, which is waywardness plus fugitivity, right? She's saying that what Du Bois announces, you know, in Souls of Black Folks as the problem of the 20th century, which is the color line, is part of a braided kind of complex line that is bound up with the cinematic, so that the color line is this sort of hidden, or all too often hidden or invisible or unremembered, unacknowledged variable, you know, that structures the cinematic. And like it strikes me that you couldn't talk about movies without talking about, you know, the color line or raciality, that relationship between stillness and motion, or position and momentum, you know, that's a thing that the movie is bound up in the apparatus of film, but it's also the story of, it's our story, you know, stillness in motion, like in Harry Jacobs' Crawl Space. So, sorry to be so long, but what I'm saying is like, when you introduced your, as a moving picture, it seemed totally apt to me.
Yeah, and I mean, I think I was really thinking about these like pre-cinematic forms, like the stereopticon, and how you imagine movement in that, and those stereopticons, you know, magic lantern slideshows where they were kind of simulating a moving picture, but there was like a moral telos to these shows, so that even as they were picturing the working class and poor people, they couldn't actually imagine their agency. So the motion that was being implied was the motion of a kind of philanthropic and reforming class. So I was trying to kind of produce like other moving pictures against that political moral trajectory of social progress and historical development. And it seems that, or even in like the slum photographs, which are about like, you know, these arrested, fixed, you know, images. I mean, like, if you would say, you know, arrested images of black sociality, that there's always there's always people who are in the frame who are looking elsewhere, so that even the kind of the lines of vision are not being controlled, that in the image is the look that would undo that gaze. And I don't know, do you know that Ulrich Bauer book on photography, Kara? Do you know, what is it? It's like photography and the Holocaust. But he has, there was a Nazi functionary who took all these pictures of the Jewish ghetto, and he reads these images and he talks about the subjects in the photograph as being posed for a future reception, like a reception that was outside of the immediate context in which those images were produced. I think it's called spectral presences or something like that. And so I was thinking about these images that way, like what are their kind of, there's the time of their production, but then there's the time of their reception and their afterlives. So just trying to mobilize all that.
I mean, to me, it just resonated so much with that one scene in Killer of Sheep, where this young boy sitting on Stan's family's porch, and he sees these girls, and he says, look at them old ugly girls. and it's like this kind of weird substitutive form of hailing, you know? He's gonna call them back into his little tiny, teeny little sphere of influence. And they don't even turn around. They just keep on going right out the frame. And as they're on their way out the frame, they just say, "Your daddy," you know? Which is, and there was something really, I felt like there, all throughout the film, there was these sort of twin, but also I think it's sometimes divergent undertows of waywardness and fugitivity that were gendered in these very specific ways. And the waywardness of those girls is, you know, or when they whoop their little boy's butt, you know, who's going to just literally going to ride his bike through them, you know, go break up their thing. But also the way the group of young boys were sort of moving through the image, where it was as if in a lot of ways the really stultifying and kind of oppressive domesticity, or sort of oppressive but also failed, partial, kind of incomplete, unfull domesticity. The domesticity that has to constantly and aggressively say, "But we ain't poor," you know, that kind of impossible domesticity that they're trying to maintain and shore up. The adults, the kids, at least on a sort of, you know, provisional level, are able to act out, you know, and to enact this fugitivity and waywardness in a way.
But I think from, you know, me, in terms of that, you know, impossible domesticity, because in some sense, I mean, the problem of, like, you know, wayward women is that they can't make a good home, and they can't make a good home because, you know, one, they're residing in that home with a lover to whom they're not married. So partly it was like, well, there are possibilities in that, you know, impossible domesticity. I mean, the problem of, you know, the Negro home at the beginning of the 20th century is that over 60% of these homes have lodgers residing within them. So the home is literally open to strangers. So in one sense, that, like, nuclear family form is never able to impose itself. And I was thinking, well, that's not a problem. Like, there's actually something there that's happening that's different, that's enabling, yeah. Right?
Anti-nuclear blackness.
Yeah, but and that's the queerness of blackness, right? It doesn't actually, it kind of like fails to produce a normative heterosexuality, but that's been labeled as the crisis of the black family since the 1900s. And I'm saying, no, let's look at this other thing that's made. And in some sense, that's what makes our present, right? Not the narratives of, like, failed heterosexual nuclear life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Can I ask a question? I was wondering, in the way that you're talking, I'm wondering, like, about the relationships that... Can everybody hear me? Sorry, is this mic on? Should I, like, speak closer? I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the relationships between... So when you're talking about fugitivity and waywardness, both of those things kind of propose a relationship between space and the law, right? Or space and the proper. Like, to be a fugitive is to be, like, on the run from the law, to be at large.
or something, which means to be like criminalized or deemed criminal or something. So I think that's like, and that means that you're like inventing another space, or you're moving from one space to another, or you're in escaping from another space, or the space that you were in is being like claimed, or it's being dispossessed from you because you're deemed to be criminal or something. And I think that that's maybe something that people in like Glasgow maybe have a way into thinking about that. And if we think about like the ways in which different parts of town, where like ways of life are effectively criminalized, or where they're dehumanized or something, to the point at which they can then be, one of the effects of that is to move them off the land that they're on and to make that more accessible to other forms of development, which is never for them, or ways in which people's, you were talking about like subsistence or something, ways in which people's subsistence is kind of like regulated by the state and effectively supposed to be allowed to access things, but like made effectively criminal or impossible to sustain or get access to. So I was just thinking about like when we went and visited people from West Gap the other day, or some of our friends from Unity, or some of the conversations that we had, just to think more about, you know, because it's like I'm very interested in how we can think here about the, you know, the terms, what are the similarities and the differences between these terms and modes of thinking that have come through Black experience, and how that maybe relates to like class experience here, or how, you know, the specific context in Glasgow or something. That's not really it's kind of a question, but I'm sort of wondering if that's a way to like open it up for other people to like have questions or talk about their experience or think through these things together with you. Is that a question? Do you want me to make it more of a question?
No. There are many questions there. There are many questions there. I mean, I think I tend to think about Black life as outside settlement. So fugitivity may be like, you know, an accelerated mode of this, or an intensified mode of this, like moving in and moving on. But even that process of like upheaval or displacement or dislocation, it's constant, and part of it, I mean, it literally becomes, you know, an arena of elaboration as people are like evicted from one place, regroup here, move out there, so that like a poor family in the 20s in Harlem might actually live in five places in the course of like a 2.5 or 3 year period. So, I mean, is that a kind of fugitivity? What's interesting about like, again, the underside of reform is that, you know, I mean, the kind of like housing reformers who create the tenement house laws, which I think of as like the project rules, which the bottom line means no life is to be lived here. You know, I mean, those tenement house laws, which are about quote unquote improving the conditions of working class and, you know, poor lives, ultimately become literally ways of policing and criminalizing them. So 20% of the Black women who are arrested for prostitution are arrested for being in violation of a tenement house law. So what does that mean? Like, you're messing around with somebody in the hallway. So you can literally be like kind of seized by, you know, the state, so that there's not settlements, but just the very effort to make certain kind of forms of life become targeted, and, you know, targeted for eradication, and uplift and eradication go hand in hand.
All right. In the, we were talking about this before, but in the Philadelphia Negro, Du Bois creates, which is this, you know, one of the sort of foundational works of sociology in the United States, which was commissioned, you know, by the sort of oligarchs who ran
Susan
the
Wharton,
city of Philadelphia.
Steel,
yeah,
right,
of Philadelphia, in part to try to, what they assumed was that in taking this commission, Du Bois would produce an interpretation of criminality and waywardness in Philadelphia social life that would, on the one hand, talk about it as a kind of both a condition but also an effect of racialization of the presence of Black people, that would then in a way create the condition for a kind of, you know, an actual, I don't know what you would call it, like a, basically, they wanted to take back over political control of the city from the white working class, but the way that they would do that would be to talk about the white working class as in some fundamental sense being endangered by the presence of black workers. Right? And Du Bois decided to do something other than that in many ways. But one of the things that he does in the book is he creates a kind of an appendix that basically gives a list of all the laws that, in his view, had a direct impact on the lives of black people in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania going back to the before independence. And one of the laws, I think, was in 1700, and it was sort of called an anti-tumult law. It basically outlawed the tumultuous gathering of two or more blacks in the public square on Sundays. So what it effectively does is it criminalizes black sociality, right? It makes being black in public, being black with another person, right? Which is, I think, actually the only way that one can be black, right? it can only ever be a public thing. I don't know that it is a private thing. But he criminalizes it. Or the state of Pennsylvania, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania criminalizes it. And then you think, well, what were they criminalizing, actually? Well, first, sociality and blackness as an irreducibly social thing. But, you know, what would two or more blacks in 1700 have been thinking about on a Sunday? Well, there's a decent chance that they would have been thinking about how to be free, yeah. Right? So that they were always actively engaged in a criminal conspiracy, right? Actively engaged in a criminal conspiracy to commit a crime against property, right? And against not just property, which is to say not themselves as property, but the very idea of property, right? The very idea of ownership. But another way to put it would be that what they were criminalizing was, well, I know and are interested in the work of Robert Cover too, mm-hmm. This ridiculously interesting criminal or lawyer, legal scholar. Who was at work in the 70s in the United States. But he has something that he calls the juris generative principle. Basically what he says is that the legal system and the courts are not in the first instance designed to regulate people who break the law or to keep people from breaking the law, but they are actually official state-sanctioned responses to the making of law, right? What they're meant to do is to monopolize the power to make law and to maintain that power exclusively for a ruling class. So what people are getting together to do, it seems to me, is to not just break the law, but to actively engage in a reconfiguration of law, in a remaking of law. And he calls this the fecundity of the juris generative principle, right? That law keeps generating new law, new modalities, new rules, new positions, new ways of thinking that then lend themselves to their own breaking, right? That it's just, and that's so that there's a fundamental criminality or waywardness that's internal to law and not outside of the law. And I think in the United States, blackness is the name that has been given to that fecundity. I think that in other places in the world, it has other names. But I think that the name blackness is not just one name among other names. And I think that name blackness ends up having a tremendous force and operates with very real effects, even here, even in what might be conceived of as the relative absence of black people. So I feel like we've already been talking about Scotland, even if it didn't quite seem like we were.
I wasn't correct.
I know.
I was wondering if you can maybe talk about the idea of home then being where home isn't, and maybe the idea of a refuge for the fugitive.
My response is like, no, there's no space of refuge. I mean, I think that there's, part of the rehearsal in anticipation of, and why I like that is to think about the kind of practices of dwelling or staying but aren't secured as home because of the kind of the circumstances in which we're still living, right? So maybe a more direct way of answering that would be to return to yesterday's question about the hovering police helicopters, right? I mean, so there's a way that sociality unfolds. Life is lived, but yet there's this kind of like threat of harassment and threat of death that kind of hovers over that. So when I think about these practices and what they created, I mean, they created these, I mean, you know, if it wasn't for the work of like well-intentioned liberal reformers and the state police and racism, well, maybe these kind of like temporary spaces of dwelling might have turned into some kind of like collective. But the nature of it is that any kind of social force that's actually kind of like in opposition to the law, derelict to capitalism, and trying to imagine other ways of being is so fundamentally targeted, right, that they're by necessity kind of like short-lived. So the practice of home, I'm just thinking about like maybe an ideology of duration and also notions of like safety and removal. So it's more to make forms of life in the context of threat and death and arrest, that those two things can't be separated. So I think of these like, you know, traditional formulations, you know, like, you know, haven in a heartless world, the notion of the kind of like the home as a retreat. And even if we go back to Du Bois, I mean, he says, you know, I mean, the home is also the hold. I mean, there's a way that the kind of the afterlife of slavery is unfolding in the social formation, but it's also, it's unfolding and it has a life inside the household, you know, too. And I mean, I think that the dance, maybe AJ was referring to in the film, I mean, even that space of intimacy is so complex and it's so fraught because of all the things that are also on them as they're dancing and as they're, you know, trying to have this connection. So I would shy away from notions of kind of, you know, refuge that might impose like an outside or a safety or an away from all these kind of, you know, forces of kind of threat and death, but like a making within that context. And yeah, and I don't know that it is bearable. I mean, it's what it means to kind of, you know, to bear the unbearable is how I would want to describe it, as opposed to like, the shit isn't bearable. We should, you know, let us never be in the place where we want to bear this, like, this infamous, you know, this infamy, this violence, this, you know, destruction. So how do we inhabit that?
It's hard to talk about it, you know. But it is unbearable. And it is, therefore, something that you, on the one hand, ought not want. You can't, it would be wrong, maybe, or obscene, or callous, or something, to want it. And yet, at the same time, I think it's absolutely necessary and essential to claim it, but to claim it in some other way, or we were talking about this the other evening, not last night, but like I don't know, Thursday night.
Yeah.
You know, Michael and M. Lamar talking about homelessness. And it's a brutal, homelessness has been brutally imposed upon us and upon other people too. And it is a kind of ethical and social imperative. All the interesting, all the work, all the thinking, all the art that I think we're interested in is a refusal of that imposition of homelessness. But it is also at the same time, I think, a refusal of what has been refused to us, namely the idea of home. There's a critique of home that emerges out of seeing how illegitimate it is insofar as it is born out of your exclusion from it, right? Well, that's bullshit. The reason this is bullshit is not just because they won't let me in, but because insofar as they won't let me in, it's bullshit, you know, it's whack, it's messed up, okay? Now, and then there's the critique of it that emerges not simply as a function of your exclusion from it, but that emerges from your recognition that the very idea of it, insofar as it requires my exclusion, is problematic. So it's this almost impossible position of both of recognizing the brutality of having home be refused to you, and at the same time recognizing that home is not what we want either, right? Like, and to me that shows up in the film so much. It's like that they're striving for a domesticity that not only is fraught and not only that they can't really have, but it's also, I want to say, however presumptuous it might seem, it's a domesticity that we can't want.
Yeah, I mean, and this makes me think about ensemble. It makes me think about the undercommon. And I was thinking like, oh, well, so if there was this thing of like home, what would it be for me? Like some combination of like the stateless society and the brothel. And by that I meant like the place that just like anybody could go to, right? Because it seems that so much like home is defined by like, you know, always those you have to keep out for its borders, at least in a certain kind of, as it's allied with certain conceptions of like, you know, possessive individualism and the wage earner and all these, you know, a certain kind of like forging of the subject and his intimate life. But I mean, I don't know if you want to just talk a bit about like those like imaginings of other, like other domains of sociality, right? Like, I mean, I think that like, yeah, home is the way, is like the kind of a privileged term for imagining the space where we do a certain kind of intimate work, where we have love, where we forge affiliation. But do we need that space to be named in that way? Like, do we want that? And so I just want you to talk more about like maybe that movement also from.
Well, I just feel like it can't be predicated on exclusion, and it can't be predicated on fixity, right? Okay, so basically, like I just wrote some shit down. I wish I could talk better, but I wish the ideas would come to me in a way that made sense.
They come good,
but it's all this shorthand kind of thing. But I was thinking, because you were talking about refuge, and I was thinking, to the extent that there's refuge, it's given in the refugee. Like refuge is something that the refugee carries with her, it seems to me. But then you have to say something even, but then it's crazier than that, because, well, it's, for instance, I wouldn't say that it's in the, well, we're gonna hear, you know, we're gonna see AJ's film and hear Hortense Spillers talking. And this important, like, for me, like, epical distinction that she makes between the flesh and the body, okay? And what I would say is, like, refuge is given in, like, the fleshly the fleshly mobility of the refugee. Like, in other words, not in the refugee's body, and it's not carried as a possession. It's not, it's really just, it's the flesh is incoherent. It doesn't fully coalesce into a body. It's this kind of materiality that never quite can conceive of or claim for itself the honor, you know, and the fixity in space and time of a body. You know, it's Wilderson talks about it as like not having a place and time in the world. And that's, for him, that's cause for mourning. For me, that's cause for celebration, to not have a fixed place and time in the world. But this fleshliness, like, again, I see it in the dancing. Like, I remember when reading The Village Voice maybe like 25 years, I think it was that long, I was in grad school, and Greg Tate wrote something about dance. It was something about, it seemed like these kids were literally trying to fling parts of their body off of themselves, right, in the dance. And you can see it, like in Miss Prissy, to me, it seems like especially, it's like she's trying to throw her hand off of her arm, you know? And it seems to me that it's a really intense reaction against the imposition or the assumption of a discrete body, right? And that's all bound up with what it means to just be rubbing up against another person. Because what you want is to be both more and less than yourself at that moment, right? And that's where refuge is in that it's this sociality of hapticality, is what my friend Steve Harney's term, you know, the sociality of rubbing up against somebody, of brushing up against somebody, right? Of not being, of claiming non-protectedness, you know, which is a fucked up thing to have to claim within the context of a history of being so violently violated all the time, right? That's what makes it so hard even to talk about it. It's like we've been put here to be prophets, so to speak, of unprotectedness by way of and out of our experience of being brutally and constantly violated.
But I think that's what was so amazing to me about lots of what was happening in Ferguson, is like this amazing presentation of that kind of vulnerability as this incredible power. Like, okay, you know, but it wasn't like in some, you know, Christian sacrificial mode, mm-hmm. but to inhabit that fleshiness as this.
It was aggressive vulnerability.
Yeah.
Aggressive public vulnerability. It was like on the floor last night. Because I was like, because I'm seeing people raising their hands, and I'm like, okay, I can't see this now. It's Ferguson is in this too, even on the dance floor, right? So what's these things seem bound up together to me, you know, in ways that are good, not problematic. Or in ways that are good and problematic.
Yeah, because it's costly.
So I'm really struggling with this. This, you know, I had a bunch of other things to ask about, but this flesh body piece is one that I'm really struggling with. And I understand the need for that level of vulnerability, and I understand conceptually what it means when we kind of claim a body and the trajectory around how that may lead us to ownership that become problematic. But I'm constantly struck by the fact that, as I mentioned on Thursday when we talked, what does it mean when you've had experiences of abuse where the rejection of the flesh is your first step towards survival? Like, how do you then begin to reclaim flesh and vulnerability in a way that becomes your ability to be in social relationship? Oftentimes it's the claiming of the body, of the essence of the body, of all of that, that what I'm hearing you say is the problematic that becomes the vehicle or the pathway for survival. And so I'm really struggling with this flesh body distinction in that way. And the other piece that is somewhat wrapped up into that. I know Barry was talking about, you know, the criminality of the everydayness, and you know, and I think about it like in very Wakantian terms, in terms of gendered containment of bodies, gendered containment of that, and how do people actually see life within that? And for women, where that gendered containment has often been, you know, like the biggest, I think, one of the biggest visible criminalization of women has been, you know, with the Welfare Reform Act, where there's been a forced containment, a forced idleness that may push up against this idea of a general strike a little bit, because, you know, these are women that appeared on the surface to be striking, but that were actively engaged in labor work at various levels. And there was a complete dismantling of that labor force, you know, whether it was, I come out of the field of community organizing, most of those organizations were run by women who were able to sustain them because they were not employed in wage work in the same way. And so, you know, you have all of these things running against each other at the same time. And so, you know, I'm just trying to figure out, one, the waywardness that understands, you know, the ways in which women have structured their lives, and their lives have been contained, and yet they still manage to creatively figure out a variety of engagements, and how those variety of engagements have been possible because of a bodily appropriation, because many of them have suffered all manners of sexual and physical abuse. And so, you know, all of these things, I know that's like, I'm all over the place, but all of these things are just kind of running together in my head right now.
I mean, I guess one of my questions is that, you know, is the way to kind of protect a body from harm to have a discourse of ownership about it, right? And it seems, I mean, I think what's also just really tricky about, you know, my work and what I study is that, you know, the people who wanted to do the protecting became involved in the production of law, of generating law, and then the kind of the violence of that kind of lawmaking practice against the very ones that they wanted to protect, right? So
But if it's from the outside in, I'm talking about what happens when, you know, because in these communities, you know, women and men are forging an understanding of who they are and how they want to live and, you know, over and against so much of that, right? So yeah, I'm not sure how that happens. Right. And, without claiming.
And can you have like a language against, you know, that may be against violence and a kind of an ethics of care that doesn't require a language of kind of self-possession? And not, so that we would get, you know, that we could arrive at some, you know, principles around like not violating others, but it wouldn't necessarily need to kind of.
Why do they have to correlate? I guess I'm just struggling with why self-possession means.
Well, yeah, well, no, I thought you were the one who, I thought you're interested in a language of ownership of the body, like what could be valuable about claiming a body as one's own.
I believe that that is valuable.
Okay.
And I'm saying what's valuable about rejecting the body in favor of the flesh. Okay. That's, I'm just trying to understand this distinction.
Well,
he was riffing on Spiller's distinction.
So, for me, well, okay. So, first of all, I think there's a kind of explicit distinction in this amazing essay that Hortense Spiller's published in 1987 called Mama's Baby, Papa's Maybe. And first of all, I think it's an impossible essay. Well, I shouldn't put it that way, but I say, but there's a companion piece to this essay, and they have to be read together, I think. And that's Baby Suggs' sermon in the woods.
Yeah, love the flesh.
In which she enjoins her congregation to love their flesh. Okay. So, and I think it's, so this distinction that Spillers makes between flesh and body is a complicated distinction, because part of what she's trying to do, I think, is to say that the experience of slavery and the condition of slavery is the condition of a radical, of a kind of being radically excluded from the very possibility of ownership. The mother cannot own her child because the mother does not own herself. Okay. And owning oneself, one way to think about it, what I think Spillers is implicitly saying here is that self-ownership or self-possession can be understood precisely by way of this distinction between flesh and body. In other words, the flesh is that which is unowned or unowned by a self. But see, there's another edge to it. If the flesh is unowned, it is not only not owned by the one who would claim it as one's own. Or in other words, it's not owned by anyone who would claim it as their own. Okay. This unprotectedness or non-ownability of the flesh turns out to be something that both militates against the self-possession of the enslaved woman, but I think it also constitutes the ground of a resistance, right, of the slave woman against the one who would own her, right? It's a complicated thing, but it's an almost impossible position to take, okay? Because first of all, you can't take it as an individual subject, because you don't have the capacity to be an individual subject, okay? It's a position that can only be taken communally, right? To love one's flesh, or to love your flesh, which is what Baby Suggs says, it's given as a communal imperative. It's different from love one another, right? It's love your flesh. It's a communal imperative. What I'm trying to say is there's another distinction that I think is implicit in Spiller's essay, but which she makes explicit in AJ's film. And it's a distinction between two modalities of unprotected flesh. There is the flesh which remains unprotected over against the master's incursions and violations of it. And then there is the flesh that remains unprotected precisely insofar as, and as the condition of possibility of our loving of our flesh. Our loving of our common flesh. In other words, for me to be involved in this communal loving of flesh, I have to remain, what could be conceived of as my flesh has to be unprotected so that it can be loved. In other words, vulnerability is the condition of possibility of love. That openness, okay? That giving of oneself over or away. Edouard Glissant calls it consent not to be a single being. And the reason I think of Glissant in relation to Spillers is because I think that this consent is almost impossible to think of separately from the position of the maternal, which to me is like the clearest possible example of consent not to be a single being. And I'm not trying to say that it's strictly gendered at that level, because it's not, okay? And this would be one possible way of interpreting the non-gendering, right? Because Spillers explicitly uses this term, that the black woman is ungendered. But another way to think through that non-gendering is to think about it in ways that are bound up with, for instance, in the ballroom scene, what motherhood and fatherhood is and has become, right? But also, so what we're talking about is a socialization of the maternal function in a way, for instance, that Orlando Patterson could never understand, right? And he would only understand it as degradation, right? And so, okay, so that's one part of it, and I'm sorry if it's not so clear. But the other part of it is like, I think that the Kantian normative conception of a self, the Humean sort of Lockean understanding of the self as a possessive individual, is predicated on the presence and locatability in space and time of a body. Like the Kantian subject, which we are taught to believe is a kind of fundamentally mental thing, a thing that's in the head, a thing that's about mind, that mindedness, so to speak, is a function of and is located in the body. And the Kantian subject is the motherfucker that wants to own motherfuckers. That is the instantiation of that subject. That subject doesn't exist outside of the capacity to own, in which self-possession is the condition of possibility of the possession of others, but self-possession only at the same time comes fully into its own by way of the ownership of others. Even if it's not other people, other things. You see what I'm trying to say? Self-possession is a conditional possibility of owning something else, but owning something else is the only way that self-possession comes fully into its own. Hegel works that out. So what I'm trying to say is like, I don't want to be that self. I'm like not going to be that self. Matter of fact, my presence here right now in this room is a function of a long-ass tradition of refusal to be that self. Okay.
But can I have a... No. And I guess, you know, I'm trying to maybe give like a historical example. I mean, Veena Das has this great essay called Language and the Transactions of Pain, where she's dealing with this amazing paradox, and it's about the partition of India. And she says, why is it at this incredible moment of the arrival of kind of independence, national identity, and citizenship, do we have this like massive violence against women, right? And she says, well, what is it about like the citizen subject and the kind of arriving at that position that in fact like turned us into monsters, right? And she raises this question about citizenship, the body, conceptions of political freedom at the very site of women's violated bodies, and she makes a call. I mean, it's interesting that she says, well, in one sense I have to go to the domain of fiction to even begin to approach an answer to this question, but she then reconceptualizes the body along the lines of flesh that I think Fred is talking about. And she says, well, you know, Western philosophers have basically failed in enabling us to understand pain. Why is that? Because they can only understand the body as this individual closed-off unit that has no fold. It has no interaction and connectivity to others. And she raises the ethical question of, what would it be to imagine the other's pain residing inside the self? Not as like imagining yourself in the other's position, but it's about that, the connectivity of the flesh. So that these questions of kind of care and protection, that the language that we are utilizing to kind of redress the problem might in fact be continuing to produce it, right? So that is it something about the conceptual model that's actually failing to produce love and practices of care that are going to be enabling for us? So I was just trying to give a simpler...
Thank you.
Yeah.
So for me, I mean, I think there's some dialectical tension, much like Charlene, but I kind of understand where you're going, and particularly this notion of that things can be liberative and oppressive at the same time. And so I'm thinking about this notion of, you know, the body and the flesh and unprotectiveness. And so in the work that I do public health, and that sort of trajectory has really severe public health consequences, right? And so what does it mean for me to be a Black gay man to be unprotected with another body has caused Black gay men to have the highest HIV prevalence rate in the whole world. Well, let me go even deeper than that. And so when we talk about this, when someone over here talked about this notion of refuge and what home may feel like, and I was thinking about the club last night, And for me, having to be in Scotland, to have to feel that feeling of home all the way over here, that in my own black community, I can't feel that, right? And so this notion of, you talked about this notion of sort of this expressing or this notion of flesh to flesh, a communal experience. But when you have a folk who have been exiled out of a community, then how do they begin to share that? I mean, what is the experience of this communal sharing of the love of the flesh if they've been told that the very essence of their flesh is antithetical to God? Let me say that even differently. The very essence of who they are is a theological problem, right? But what I do like about it is that the Black Gay Club allowed for this beginning to rub up against one another's body as liberative, right? But part of that is around, if I've been told that who I am is antithetical to God, and that as a result of that, that this notion of disease, HIV, happens not because of any unprotectedness around my sex, but has everything to do with the intersection of being black and gay. My rubbing up against one's body is important, particularly because it doesn't matter if I'm unprotected sexually, because I'm going to become HIV positive anyway. So that the very essence of who I am, my very creation, is not only antithetical to God, but as a consequence of that, is that I'm a diseased spirit, and I'm a diseased body. No, let me say it different. I am a demonized spirit who the ramification is the diseased body. And so for me, I'm having trouble with this. So I agree with it because I think about quantum mechanics' notion of consciousness, right? So I hear that, right? But I'm also in this notion of time and space, and the spirit goes beyond that. But I'm having problem with the language of unprotectedness, particularly when you talk about real lived communities. And so it has real consequences. Sometimes I think that we engage in what I call academic vernacular, right? That stays in one space. It's schizophrenic. It stays in one space. But when it tries to live within the community, it doesn't work. And so I oftentimes wonder why we're having this conversation. Not that it's not important to have this conversation, but I just think they have real consequences. Like Charlene was talking about, I'm really struggling with. And the notion that, if I don't believe that if I can't claim my body, then there's no way that I can protect myself, right? There's a protection around claiming my body, an ownership of my body, because if not, then what happens, and particularly in a public health trajectory, there's so many consequences for not owning my body, claiming my body. I think about last night, as y'all talked about, I'm thinking about the way that Kia performed last night, the owning of her body. Here's this black woman, and she'll talk about her experience. Black woman only knowing a certain trajectory around disease, only knowing that, but the claiming of her body in that moment, in that time, I just think was so liberative, and it was so important. I'll go all over the place too, but I'm really struggling with it too. But I do like the conversation because it does make me think beyond what I know, right? So I do like the conversation, but I do think that there has public health consequences, and particularly I oftentimes believe, particularly as black folk, and I talk to Barry about this all the time, that oftentimes I think about in the tradition of sort of black discourse, the question around sexuality is never really thought about. And if it is, it's an afterthought, but it's not really, really engaged, right? And so, this notion of, I think about these black trans bodies. We're talking about this earlier today around this fluid trans discourse. You know, we'll talk about what realness is, what it means to be read as real. I have a good friend of mine, and I'll keep this real short, even though it's been long enough, but I have a very good friend of mine named Vivian, who is the overall mother in my house. And she transitioned late in life. She's about 45. She started transitioning around 29. And she transitioned on her job. So when she got hired, she was hired, read as a black man. and a black gay man because she was out. She transitioned into a trans woman while working on her job on Wall Street. So that's one trajectory, right? And so that she's out about being trans, she's read as real, but she checks out of trans when she's dating her man because her man, her man's heterosexual or defines himself that way and his family doesn't know. So that's one way. Then I have trans friends of mine who was read as real, and that is their project, to assimilate, to pass. Then I have what we call the femme queen. And the femme queen's a ballroom term. And it's political, right? And the politics is around, they may overdo the breast and overdo the hip and have this small waist. And sometimes the feminist's critique is that they are reducing women to hyper notions of femininity. Yet, one of their conversations is that I want you to see that I'm not what you call a man, but I'm not trying to pass. This is the woman's notion of self-creation. And that claiming of one's body is so important, not only for survival, but resiliency from historical oppressions that continue to be against this person's spirit. That oftentimes I think in these kinds of conversation is always missing.
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, I guess I apologized for the way I talked before.
Oh no, apologize.
But I'm not. But I, you know, academic vernacular. I don't know what this means. But what I do know is that there's a real world to which I have access, I suppose, and I'm not the only one who has access to it, within which what I'm saying is descriptive and not just prescriptive.
Well, can I say something? Because I think, I mean, for me, this is a really important conversation. I would say that people are talking about it, and people who have lived certain things are talking about it in academia and outside of it. So I do think it's worth troubling that distinction. I would also say for me, like, one of the things that I've tried to think about is this question around vulnerability, and I've done it through visibility, like the kinds of protection that visibility, the very limited kinds of protection that visibility affords. And what I'm wondering, and I'm also actually wondering this through my reading of Fred's work, because there's a way in which I want to ask, when you were talking about the dancer last night and the ownership of her body, right, and the way that that becomes meaningful, my question, I think, is about to what extent it becomes meaningful precisely because it's shared also, and how what we're talking about in some ways is not simply an ownership, but also the way that that becomes a way of sharing. And I don't know if sharing is like the right word for that, right? But a way of opening up and connecting so that it's not just ownership, but it's a way that the actions that we take, you know, as queer people to try to find ways to live, right? Also tap into something that's not actually just about us all the time or about ourselves, but that is a relying upon the notion that there is a community and that what we're doing is also in that context. So I don't know if we would call it sharing, but it looks like you would jump in, so go ahead.
There's just a lot that I also have to pee, so I'm gonna keep it real short. The thing that it makes me think about is it's not just, so I work at, do community organizing, and it makes me think about, like, it's not just important that we're resisting, but how we resist violence, is like the emphasis on the how is really important. And because one of the things in coming from New York and you know working with other trans women of color, is that this is the year that we've, you know, as documented, the highest mortality, highest homicide rate against trans women of color ever documented in the U.S., alongside great visibility of people like Laverne mm-hmm. Cox being on Time and those things happening at the same moment. And thinking about the call so often when violence, or the call so recently so often when violence against like LGBT people happens is for protections, like legalized protections and legalized sanctions to prevent violence. And how that those kinds of calls for protections really result in the criminalization of our community. So I'm thinking about like hate crime legislation as like protections for us that really didn't work, but and resulted in a lot more forms of policing against the very people that needed space from violence. And then I'm also thinking about when Jesse Jackson went to Watts for Watts Stacks and had that kind of speech during Watts Stacks about how we may be poor, we may be on welfare, but we are somebody, right? We may be unskilled, but we are somebody. And then kind of goes through the litany of that and about how we must be respected and how we must be protected. And I just think, like, I'm just reflecting on the cost of, like, the call for protection that has happened to, like, LGBT people of color versus the call for space from violence. But, I really am connecting to, like, I don't want to be violated anymore. Like, I don't want to go outside, go to the subway, and be harassed or, like, I need some space from that kinds of violence. And thinking about the primary way that people are afforded, think that they're afforded space is through the police, through these kinds of protections that are structured to kill us. So I'm really like really connecting to what y'all are saying, and the idea of moving against the call for protection.
Yeah, I mean,
can I just say quickly that like. Sorry to say this, but like our like sessions aren't based around Raina's bladder capacity or something, but we're like running out of time for this thing in order to be able to do the next ones. And if any imposed structure is always the wrong structure, and I apologise for that. Maybe structure is the problem, but it's also we maybe have like 5 minutes max or something. So I just want to open it out if there's anybody in the room who. Would like to say something that hasn't been able to say something, or if people around the table have other comments, that would be.
I just wanted to say one quick thing. I think we should just, we should try to be as comfortable as possible inside of this seemingly dissonance that's happening here, because all this is I see the kind of conversation that Fred and Sadia are having is a conversation in, you know, what typically we call a philosophical space, but it's a space where they're actually trying to tangle with certain paradoxes that just aren't going to be gotten around. And the implications of those paradoxes are things like calling for certain kinds of legislation and assuming that legislation is going to solve the problem. But the space of this paradox that they're exploring is a space where we precede understanding that certain kinds of calls are ultimately going to be ineffective. It's not to say we shouldn't gather and be collective in our efforts to protect one another and have good practices and all this kind of stuff, but I think the tension between the two of the pragmatic, instrumental application of our thinking, our ability to think our situation is happening over here. So we have to, accept the unconstrained exploration of these ideas here so that they can actually make the kinds of manifestations over here that I think we all collectively want, or something like that.
Thanks for organizing this, and I'm someone who's been following Fred's and Sadia's work from afar for some time. I've always been interested in their discussion around what it would mean to be black. But my point of entry is from not being African American. Never set foot on African American soil. American soil.
I like that, African American soil. American
soil. But a lot of stuff that you guys talk about or write about resonates with me from within the Eritrean situation. So I'm an Eritrean refugee. So a lot of stuff was, a lot of terms were thrown out: fugitivity, refugee, blackness. I'm kind of all of those things, and I don't really have a sort of a recent history of slavery within my sort of social makeup. But when Fred was talking about his grandmother and Susie, it reminded me of my grandmother within the context of colonized Eritrea, and she was a servant working in an Italian family's home. And my grandmother was from the, what would you call it, from the countryside. She only came to the to Asmara, to downtown, to find work. And talk of the town was there are these white people who will let you clean up after them and let you live in their homes. And my grandmother told me the story that happened to her. And recently, my grandmother died 10 years ago. Recently, my mom retold the story, so I actually still have it in my mind now. One day she was sent out to get groceries from the shop. And there's a separate line in which you wait for, you know, to go up to the till. There's a white line and then there's the black line. And my grandmother was new to town, so she didn't know. She just went straight into the white line. And the white lady was behind her, I think. I forget the details, but she said, kind of like, you know, in that privileged kind of way, what is this thing doing here? Like, somebody tell her she's not supposed to be here. And they get into an argument, and your grandmother used different tones of address. My grandmother smacked her in the face. And to tie this up with something, and this was a huge deal. At that time, people feared for her life. They thought this is going to be a problem. They had to hush it up. Some other white ladies who knew her master, sort of quickly got her off the space where she was at, and she survived. But that risk she took. And to tie it up to something you guys were talking about earlier, in terms of how Wilderson might think of that distinction as a reason for mourning, I don't think there is something to be mourned about that. But I think Wilderson is more thinking about how do I incite, how do I somehow make people see that this shit is unbearable, and therefore, how can I incite people to smack back? Rather than, although that's not the wrong thing to do, rather than to create spaces or fugitive flights. I'm also riffing on you. I mean, it's violence. If we take violence as the primacy agent or the primacy force under which we have to then fashion ourselves, against which we have to fashion ourselves, then we have no way to go but to continue the line that violence has prescribed for us. And then meet it full on, whatever the repercussions may be. And the one word I haven't heard used today is revolution. From within the Eritrean context, what came after the Italians was a long period of guerrilla warfare and fighting for independence. I don't believe that did something, but after that, it just reproduced the same logic of colonialism. Or state repression, or whatever you want to call it. But I think it did something then. Maybe we could think about how we could do something again. And for me, the conversation between you and Frank is very helpful.
Well, we've never really had a conversation. Well. That's another matter.
Okay.
But I
would,
I was going to say something like, well, but you know, my grandmother was a revolutionary. But I'm not going to say that just because I'm not sure exactly what that means either. But what I will say is that the condition of not having which is to say not owning a body of one, not having a body of one's own, is an unbearable condition. But the condition of thinking that you have a body of your own is also unbearable. And deeper still, the general condition that emerges from a bunch of crazy people running around thinking that they have a body of their own is not only unbearable for them, it's unbearable for the earth.
Yeah.
And what's at stake here is not only Black liberation, which, you know, is dear to my heart, but what's also at stake, what's at stake in the problematic of Black liberation, is the actual existence of the earth as a habitable place for human beings, whether human beings deserve to inhabit it or not. And for me, the ownership of a body, the delusion of ownership of a body, is directly tied to the absolute endangerment, okay, of the earth.
Sadia,
we're really running out of time, so if you can be quick, this is going to be the last thing.
I'm sorry. I would just echo that and say, like, let's just historicize the question. When did we imagine conceiving of a relationship to our flesh in the idiom of ownership? And can we think about that before the emergence of capitalism?